It's going to present, once again, a little different topic than we've been looking at this morning, looking at syringes as biological potholes.
Yeah, I'm the token syringomyelia speaker looking at the program here. Everybody else seems to be speaking about hydrocephalus, so I hope you'll bear with me a bit, and I hope to justify the rather irreverent title of the talk by the time it's done. So you all know that syringomyelia is from the Greek, meaning a pipe in the marrow, and it's a tubular cavity in the spinal cord. Most often, it's associated with an extramedullary lesion at the foramen magnum. Most of these are Chiari 1 malformations, but there are others that are listed here that also are associated with syringomyelia. And in these cases where the lesion is in the region of the foramen magnum, the syrinx nearly always involves the cervical spinal cord and extends variably for a considerable distance caudally. So here are just some examples for those of you who work only on hydrocephalus of syrinx. You can see how it reaches up in the cord, but doesn't really obviously in most cases communicate with the fourth ventricle. Here are some from a paper where they really try to classify them morphologically. There's the very distended, smooth contour type, and there's a sort of beaded type. The manilliform means like a necklace. It doesn't have to be dilated. It can be very slender, like the third one, or it can be sort of in patches, like the one all the way on the extreme right. This is just an example to show you that syringomyelia doesn't require obstruction of the subarachnoid space at the foramen magnum. It can occur lower down. Here is something at 2, 3, 4, 5. At C5, 6, a cervical spondylotic ridge, and below that you can see the white cord signal that is CSF in the syrinx on this T2 weighted image. Or it's not CSF, you'll see it. It's fluid in the syrinx. Okay. So from a neuropathological standpoint, there are really two types of cases. There's the communicating syringomyelia, where the syrinx is around or over a cavity lined with a pendema, and it's really a dilatation of the central canal that does open into the fourth ventricle, and it occurs usually in infants who also have hydrocephalus and Chiari 2 malformations. This is not what I'm talking about today. I'm talking about the non-communicating form, which is far more common. The syrinx here is an irregular forked cavity, branching cavity that extends rostrally and close to but doesn't communicate with the fourth ventricle. The cavity most often occupies gray matter or the junction between gray and white matter. The cavity is lined by many different things. Parts of it are lined by a pendema, suggesting it's a dilatation of part of the central canal, but other parts are lined by glia or even by fibrous tissue. And there's very extensive gliosis that surrounds the cavity, and in fact, you can in some patients just see, especially if you get examine at autopsy, just sheets of non-cavitated gliotic tissue in the spinal cord, and this occurs most often in adults with the Chiari 1 malformation. So I want to review with you the various theories of pathogenesis so that I can justify the outlandish theory that I'm going to present a little later on. The early controversy was whether syringomyelia was a developmental disorder or an acquired disorder. The people who postulated a developmental mechanism, and now we're talking about 70 years ago, a long time ago, the people who postulated developmental mechanism, the mechanism was a failure to approximate the lateral plates of the cord so as to form the dorsal median septum that divides the two dorsal horns of the spinal cord. But this theory was really, excluded by the occurrence of syringomyelia with clearly acquired lesions, like meningioma. So people, adults who have developed meningioma at the foramen magnum and then developed the syrinx. And there are many other, now very few people would consider a developmental theory for syringomyelia. The people who were pushing for acquired mechanism this long time ago, they were talking about ischemia or what they called lymph stasis, which I've never quite fully understood, of the central spinal cord, and this was supposed to lead to gliosis and then degeneration of the glia and accumulation of fluid. But there, too, there's no pathological evidence of occlusive vascular disease with infarction, and no mechanism that I knew for this lymph stasis. So these two points of view are really just sort of moot right now. These were superseded by the early hydrodynamic theories, and the most famous exponent, the first to postulate this kind of theory, was the neurosurgeon from Cleveland, Gardner, who thought that there was it was a bit developmental, a delay in the perforation of the roof of the rhombencephalon. So that the subarachnoid space was not fully dissected open, and so then extensive exaggerated pulsations from the ventricles, they were exaggerated because there was no venting through the subarachnoid space because of this delay opening, were conveyed down into the central canal and caused it to dilate. Bernard Williams, the British neurosurgeon, had another take on this, and he thought that the lesion at the foramen magnum acted as a valve that allowed the CSF to pass rostrally from the spinal space to the intracranial space more easily than caudally. It was sort of a one-way valve, and so that activities like coughing would lead would push the CSF rostrally, and now the pressure would be elevated rostrally compared to caudally, and the fluid would be sucked from the CSF would be sucked from the fourth ventricle again into the central canal to dilate it. But Gardner's theory fails because only a minority of patients with syringomyelia of the non-communicating type have hydrocephalus, and the exaggerated pressure and pulsations in the ventricles should have made them hydrocephalic. And neither his theory nor Williams can explain the main point about non-communicating syringomyelia, that it's non-communicating. So how is CSF being driven from the fourth ventricle to the central canal if there's no communication between the syrinx and the fourth ventricle? So these early hydrodynamic theories were supplanted by what I would call the prevailing modern hydrodynamic theories of syringomyelia. And in this case, the fluid in the syrinx is not CSF from the fourth ventricle, but rather CSF from the spinal subarachnoid space. There is a theory by Bell and Dion whereby coughing or straining increased the epidural venous pressure, which makes good sense because the intrathoracic pressure goes up, it presses on the epidural veins, and they thought that this CSF, because of the foramen magnum lesion, couldn't move intracranially, and so this increased pressure pushed it into the spinal cord to create a syrinx. Another theory by Aboukir was that the CSF ordinarily produced in the spinal compartment, it does produce some CSF, that it normally drained rostrally into the intracranial space, and when you made a lesion, you had a lesion at the foramen magnum that prevented that drainage, the pressure would build up in the spinal subarachnoid space and again flow into the spinal cord, presumably along the perivascular channel. And the one that's been most prevalent, the theory that's been most dominant, is that of Oldfield, Heiss, and Levy, whereby it's cardiac pulsations that are providing the pump here, and these pulsations that ordinarily are seen not only intracranially but in the spinal subarachnoid space, that they're exaggerated by a piston effect of the cerebellum, which is being pushed down with every systole because of the blockage of CSF flow. The cerebellum is pushed down, and that creates a a piston effect and pushes the fluid in the spinal subarachnoid space into the spinal cord. So I undertook first to really see if these theories made biophysical sense, and only really decided to work hard on this topic once I was convinced that they didn't make biophysical sense. And I want to just mention some of the considerations that influenced me. First, the mean pressure of syrinx fluid is greater than the mean pressure of CSF in the subarachnoid space, almost always. And this is a problem for every theory that postulates flow from the spinal subarachnoid space into the syrinx. Flow goes from high pressure to low pressure, and here they're postulating that it's going from low pressure to higher pressure. With regard to the old field theory, I think that the piston mechanism of the cerebellar tonsil is very questionable, since I think the cerebellar excursions probably do no more than replace the CSF excursions that are being excluded by the blockage at the foramen magnum. So to me, it doesn't make any difference whether it's fluid that's coming down and causing the pulsations in the spinal subarachnoid space or cerebellar tissue. I don't see why it would have to be greater in the latter case than in the former. With regard to the ball and Dion theory, I think increase in the pressure of the epidural veins should be transmitted immediately to the veins of the spinal cord. And these should expand and increase interstitial fluid in the spinal cord. So again, there's no pressure gradient to drive the spinal CSF into the cord. And with regard to the Albuquerque theory, complete foramen magnum, that's what FM stands for here. You should know that by now. So complete foramen magnum block leads to lower CSF pressure in the spinal than in the cranial subarachnoid space. That's just an experimental fact. And if drainage were normally rostral, as he postulated, the spinal subarachnoid pressure should rise above the cranial subarachnoid pressure as the undrained fluid builds up in the spinal cord, but it's actually the reverse. It's the pressure intracranially that is higher than that in the spinal subarachnoid space when there is a complete block separating the two compartments. And finally, with regard to all of these theories, it's very questionable whether a CSF circulation through the perivascular spaces of the spinal cord actually exists. And if it does, the changes in CSF pressure in the spinal subarachnoid space do not constitute an adequate pump, because these pressure changes are being applied to the ingress and the outflow channels of the fluid. And you're applying the same pressure to the inflow and outflow, you're not supplying a pressure gradient, you're not supplying a pump. So these were my problems with the current hydrodynamic theories. And there are other problems with them that relate to neuropathology. None of these theories could explain the dilated, thick-walled vessels that lie within and around syrinx cavities. If fluid were being forced around perivascular channels, the veins and capillaries should collapse with a greater pressure outside. None of them explain the widespread gliosis, which is often solid without cavitation. None of them explain the differences in chemical composition that are frequently seen between, especially protein content, between syrinx fluid and CSF. It's true, syrinx fluid is often low in protein, but there are really significant differences often between the protein content in those two fluids. So here's the new theory, for what it's worth. I agree with Williams. Williams' work was backed by, I think, pretty decent experimentation and measurements. And I think the lesion at the foramen magnum does act as a one-way valve and creates repetitive, transient episodes of craniospinal CSF pressure difference due to any one of these pumps that have been mentioned before, CSF pressure pulsations during the cardiac cycle, The ordinary venting is prevented, so there's a transient increase in pressure above the block compared to below the block because the fluid can't get through that ordinarily gets through in systolic. Coughing can do it by increasing venous pressure. Release of Valsalva in straining, and even assuming the erect posture, and I'll get to that a little later on. In contrast to the broken column of CSF, the two separate hydrostatic columns, if you will, the venous column remains unbroken because the veins have extensive anastomoses even outside the vertebral bodies themselves, and they're not, the continuity of venous pressure is not interrupted by a block in the foramen magnum. So what happens is that because the venous pressure column is unbroken, and in the CSF column you have increased pressure above the block but decreased pressure below it, that means that the transmural venous pressure will decrease above the block because of the elevated pressure outside the veins in the CSF. So that transmural venous pressure goes down, but below the block, the transmural venous pressure increases because the venous pressure remains the same, but there's a lowering of the pressure outside the vein wall in the CSF. So what happens is, as a result of these changes in transmural venous pressure, there's going to be venous dilation below the block and venous contraction above the block. And in the area of the block, you then have a nonlinear step-like change in transmural venous pressure. And I claim that change in that nonlinear change in tissue volume due to the venous dilation below and venous contraction above creates stresses on the spinal cord. And these stresses due to uneven tissue dilation are the very same stresses that are studied by engineers as thermal stress. What is thermal stress? Thermal stress is uneven heating of a material that produces uneven expansion in one part and less expansion in another, and that creates stress in the material. It's called thermal stress, and that can be very disruptive of the material, and it is probably the major cause of potholes in roads, and may have been the cause, for all we know, of the ruptured steam pipe on 41st Street in Manhattan that you all heard about on your TV sets or witnessed last week, where cold water seeped onto a very warm pipe filled with steam. That's a cause of stress on the pipe and can cause a pipe rupture. Now, the repeated tissue stress, I would claim, causes tissue damage where the stresses are greatest. And these can consist of disruption of the neuropil, demyelination, tearing of axons and cell membranes, and that as happens with any source of chronic low-grade tissue disruption, there's a stimulation of chronic gliosis, and that this stress can also disrupt the blood-brain barrier, particularly below the block where the capillaries and veins are distended, and you might think of the tight junctions as being pulled apart by the venous distension to some degree, allowing crystalloids to leak and producing edema of the cord. That's an ultrafiltrate of plasma, and I think most of you are aware now of the finding that there is a pre-searing state of just diffuse cord edema that has been described, and then the fluid ultimately may drain into open segments of the central canal, causing it to distend, and so that you have holes in the cord itself and widening of the central canal. So we tried to model this in a very rudimentary way, and this is really calls for some more mathematical sophistication, maybe numerical methods to model this better. But the one model, it's to try to ascertain where along the rostrocaudal dimensions of the cord with a foramen magnum lesion you would expect a tissue disruption to occur. We just considered the cord to be a circular cylinder that was homogeneous and isotropic, and that we just try to model what happens with the erect posture. We assume that they're in the presence of a complete rigid block. You would create two distinct hydrostatic columns, and one above the block and one below, whereas the venous column would remain continuous. And this is an example of what such a thing might look like. This dotted line that comes down here, that's the venous pressure. This is the CSF pressure that is discontinuous. This is the area of the block. And the solid line is the transmural venous pressure that would ensue. And so this was the pressure that we used as the input to our model of thermal stress, and we tried to calculate what the stress distributions would be with this kind of input of transmural pressure differences. And the equations of thermal stress I just list here, these are just the ordinary equations of elasticity here, but there's this extra term with the temperature, and the alpha is just the coefficient of expansion. For those of you who like to do the poroelastic models of the brain, these are the exact same equations as poroelasticity, where in poroelasticity, pressure substitutes for temperature. But the equations are the same, so the solutions are the same, and one can jump back and forth among the literature. And these are just the boundary conditions, which I won't go into. And we then solved this with a finite element model, and this is the distribution of maximum shear stress. This is the area of the block. This is caudal to the block, and look at the maximum shear stress there compared to, there's a little rise rostral to the block, but not nearly as great. So the maximum shear stress is right at the caudal margins of the block. That's the area that should suffer the most tissue damage and where a syrinx should begin. Then we will also want to know what might happen along the cross-section of the cord, when we consider a slightly more complex model with a little hole in the center, the central canal, and an area of gray matter around it, and an area of white matter surrounding that. This is what we found. There's a stress concentration at the central canal. There's a stress concentration where the gray matter meets the white matter, and that made sense to us because wherever two areas of different mechanical properties abut one another, there's a tendency for stress to concentrate there. And in general, the stress is a little greater in the gray matter than it is in the white matter. This model then shows that with assumption of the upright posture, stress concentrates at the caudal and at the cranial borders of the block. The caudal border is the more likely site of syrinx formation because that's where the vessels dilate as opposed to constrict. I'll just move on. The second model that we did shows that the stress concentrates at the central canal and the gray-white junction. And I'm going to move on there too because I'm running out of time. So in general, this model does predict the general topographic features of non-communicating syringomyelia with a foramen magnum lesion. It also would be consistent with the extensive gliosis as a reaction to chronic repetitive stress with the thick-walled vessels, because the stress does result from repetitive vasodilation. With edema as a result of the ultrafiltration of plasma from the disrupted tight junctions, and it would be certainly consistent with the syrinx pressure being higher than the pressure in the subarachnoid space. And finally, this is consistent with the temporal course of syringomyelia. Syringomyelia is a peculiar disease that goes on for years. It develops, it's not like like hydrocephalus. It's a little different animal here. It develops over many years, and I think it's the result of stress from this repetitive, uneven expansion producing cumulative damage over a long time, similar to repetitive low-intensity stress in other tissues, the stress fractures of your foot, for example. And I think that this accounts for the slowly progressive nature of syringomyelia in the majority of the patients, and it's also consistent with the precipitation or aggravation of symptoms by straining, coughing, sneezing, or assumption of the erect posture. Thank you.